This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Daily Digest on The Bigger Picture with me, Juliet Jacobs, joined by Lim Soo Ann and Dashrin Johan. So two stories for you as always. And in our first story, as the world continues to grapple with the COVID-19 pandemic, much of the global media coverage of the crisis comes from Western media outlets. But many observers have pointed out that this coverage tends to undermine or overlook the efforts and achievements of non-white or non-Western countries. So we're going to discuss the issue of racism when it comes to global media coverage of the pandemic and how it reflects a larger need to decolonize discussions on global health.
And for our second story, 2020 has been an eventful year for Malaysian politics, to say the least, with the sudden change in government that happened in February up until the recent Sabah state elections. There's been no shortage of news about the political scene, which can feel overwhelming for some. So could this lead to people feeling disillusioned and apathetic about politics?
So on that note, you know, tell us, are you feeling disillusioned with local politics? And you can tell us why as well. So that's first, we have a poll up on Twitter, so you can vote yes or no. But you can also tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899.
Yes, and we're going to be discussing that in full after the break. But now in our first story, news headlines around the world are, of course, dominated by the COVID-19 pandemic, as we all collectively continue, you know, to grapple with the global health crisis. And much of the media coverage of this, specifically global coverage, comes from Western media outlets. And that is to say, we might read about our own country's COVID-19 issues from local news outlets. But for what's happening in other countries, we largely depend on media organizations from the West. But, you know, what many observers are pointing out, you know, is how this coverage tends to undermine or overlook the efforts and achievements of non-Western countries. And this is despite the fact that many Asian and African countries have actually done a much better job at handling COVID-19 compared to Western countries.
And one article that got quite a bit of attention on this issue lately was a Medium article written by Sri Lankan writer Indi Samarajeva, titled "The Overwhelming Racism of COVID Coverage," which was published earlier this month. The article suggests that when it comes to Western media coverage of COVID-19 globally, countries that are predominantly white or wealthier are framed as having taken active action to combat the pandemic, while countries in Asia or Africa are often portrayed as having managed it through luck or some other unexplained factor. So to put it bluntly, the writer Samarajeva says many of these Western articles can't seem to fathom the possibility that these non-white, less rich countries could actually have better public healthcare systems, or that they actually manage to react early and effectively, or that they might actually be able to learn something from these countries.
Yes, and the Medium article points out, you know, a few examples as well. So for instance, an article published in August in the New York Times, headline, "No one knows what Thailand is doing right, but so far it's working." well, what a headline that itself. So the article tries to figure out, you know, whether there might be a genetic component to Thailand's relatively low transmission rates, instead of acknowledging the country's robust public health response. And meanwhile, the New York Post, which perhaps is not as high in credibility compared to the New York Times, but definitely it's quite widely read. The Post ran an article earlier this month titled, "Scientists Can't Explain Puzzling Lack of Coronavirus Outbreaks in Africa." Well, you know, not at all considering that it might simply boil down to strong healthcare and excellent scientists.
And you nearly did a Freudian slip there. You nearly said condescending instead of
condescending.
I know what's on your mind. But, you know, as Samarajeva also points out, largely white nations like New Zealand and Germany are being lauded in the Western media for their management of the pandemic, while ignoring other Asian or African countries that have done equally well or even better for that matter. He compares, for instance, the fact that Germany and Vietnam actually have the same population size, and yet 10,000 people have died in Germany compared to only 35 in Vietnam. And meanwhile, New Zealand's excellent response does deserve to be praised, of course, but he points out that this is also a very remote and relatively sparse country, and that countries like Mongolia, which share a border with China, have also done very, very well. And not to mention even densely populated African countries like Ghana, Senegal, or Rwanda, which we hardly hear of, you know. And he goes on to say how when these media outlets do talk about non-white countries, it tends to focus on only the rich ones, so such as Japan or South Korea. And again, because what could they possibly have to learn from these other so-called poor and underdeveloped countries, right?
Mm.
And this Medium article isn't the only one that points out these sorts of massive gaps in Western media coverage. An opinion piece in Al Jazeera back in May by Nairobi-based writer and political cartoonist talked about how differently the impact of COVID-19 on the Western world is depicted compared to health crises in other parts of the world. He pointed out how during the Ebola epidemic in 2014, Western media overwhelmingly focused on death tolls, masses of dead bodies and images of grieving families, a marked difference from how the effects of COVID-19 now in the West is being covered. He too points out the lack of coverage in Western media of pandemic success stories in Africa, as well as not even differentiating between different African nations.
And in another commentary piece, and this was by editor of The Conversation, Misha Ketchel, which was written in July, that also touched on this issue, which is, you know, comparing the current pandemic to covering the coverage of the AIDS crisis in Africa. And Ketchel pointed out how unequal media coverage resulted in an undermining of various African countries' public health systems. He also said that this resulted in a reluctance from global economy players to both acknowledge the inherent inequalities of world funding for healthcare and unwilling to contribute more to help the situation.
Yes, and those are just some ways in which Western media's huge blind spot can have an actual impact on the countries that they overlook. But its impacts, but it also impacts their own countries as well. So as Samarajiva points out in his Medium article, the lack of coverage on countries that have actually managed to handle COVID-19 means that many Western countries don't even think of implementing models that might have worked elsewhere. So he goes on to say that economic success or the idea of, you know, quote unquote, a developed world keeps many Western policymakers from taking ideas from Asia or Africa that might help their own struggle with the pandemic. And just to quote from his article, and he says, "For your own health, see us. Learn about how early aggressive action in Mongolia prevented them from having any local transmissions at all. Learn about how Ghana used pooled testing to make the most of scarce resources. Learn how Sri Lanka shut down completely for 2 months with just 100 cases and is now completely normal."
Mm. So to help us contextualize all this within the larger landscape of global health, we have on the line a health policy specialist, Dr. Koh Swee Kang. Dr. Koh, to start with, do you agree with the Medium article that the way Western media has been covering the COVID-19 outbreak globally has been skewed and possibly driven by racist assumptions about the global South?
Well, the article that you're referring to is a blog post written on Medium. To come to your conversation, or to your question rather, is to say firstly that Western media is too large to be generalized, and it's difficult to make, sweeping statements or to say that Western media does or does not do a particular thing. But having introduced that caveat and having said that, it is true that Western coverage generally is skewed against other parts of the world, because they're seeing the world through very Western lenses, which have a peculiar sociocultural, sociopolitical, and also an anthropological context as well. Zooming specifically into the global health arena and drawing a distinction between, shall we say, the global North and the global South, it is true that the mass media depictions and portrayal of the global South could try to do a few things which they wouldn't otherwise do for their own coverage in their own respective countries. And what they will try to do for the global South is to romanticize, to exoticize, or to otherwise draw a cultural difference between, shall we say, Western versus Eastern responses in health systems, specifically as it relates to COVID. There's a long way of saying that I agree with you that Western media coverage could be skewed against the Global South, and they might not be reporting to the same vocabulary or methods that they would apply when they're reporting on the health systems and health policies of Western countries.
And what is the wider impact of this kind of media coverage, both on the audience as well as the handling of the pandemic?
We have to talk about colonialism, anti-colonialism, and neo-colonialism right now. And the impact, the first impact would be to preserve the ideals of colonialism. And we've all known that these ideals have been discredited for many decades already. And many countries and many people are rejecting ideas of colonialism, including neo-colonialism. What I mean to say is that the first impact would be to entrench these ideals, which have previously been discredited, and many people are fighting against it already. The entrenchment of colonialism is actually in the mindsets and maybe even the policy making of people in the West. And when I say the mindsets, this is difficult to ascertain, but the policy making could be easier to discern and easier to discern in the following ways. We can see this in the way that grants are provided by richer countries in the West to poorer countries in the East or in the South, follow the dictates or follow the perceptions of Western reporting. In other words, grants by organizations like grant-making organizations like Grant Gates Foundation or the Wellcome Trust could be dependent sometimes on the media narratives in the newspapers that they read in the morning before they go to work. That's one way in which this is entrenched. And secondly, the second way in which it's entrenched is on the people in the Global South that may not provide enough credit to themselves, because the health system responses of countries like Thailand and Vietnam are predicated on investment, strategic planning, as well as very powerful insights about their own systems limitations and also their own cultures, and not based on some exoticism or mysticism. And it does a great disservice to the people over in the Global South, as well as in the emerging world as well.
So you just mentioned Vietnam and Thailand, Dr. Kaur. What, in your opinion, are some of the other approaches taken by, you know, so-called non-Western countries that have shown effective handling of the pandemic?
It's a very long list of things that we've done well. When I say we, I mean people in Southeast Asia, people in Asia Pacific. Let me focus it on Asia, a continent that we're all familiar with and where I've published most extensively. So Asia has done a few things well. Let's trace it back to the 2003 SARS pandemic. We've done three specific things well in the last 17 years. The first thing that we've done is to increase investment in our health systems, public health systems, health surveillance systems, disease notification, disease control systems, including the human capital needed to run the systems, meaning we trained epidemiologists, we trained scientists, we trained public health physicians, data scientists, mathematicians, IT specialists, mathematical modelers, and so on and so forth, in order for us to prepare for the next pandemic. And this is a very structured investment. As one specific point, Vietnam, since 2003, year on year, increased their public health spending by 9%. That's a 9% year-on-year increase in public health investment, and that has given them a fantastic response to COVID this time around. That's the first thing that Asian countries have done well. The second thing that Asian countries have done well is to build a non-health infrastructure. What I've described earlier is to build a health infrastructure, everything to do with science and epidemiology. But not only that, there was a non-health infrastructure that was built, notably in South Korea and in Taiwan and in Hong Kong, where telecommunications companies like the equivalents in Malaysia would be the Maxis Telecoms and DGs of Malaysia, combined forces to aid contact tracing. South Korea created a privacy framework so that the Korean Center for Disease Control, or KCDC, could utilize the data for movement tracking purposes without violating the privacy of the of South Koreans. In terms of regulatory framework as well, South Korea and Vietnam excelled in providing a regulatory framework outside of the health system to support their health experts when conducting a response to the pandemic. That's the second thing that Asian countries have done well, a non-health infrastructure. And the third and final thing that Asian countries have done well, they've not wasted the crisis of 2003 in SARS, is actually to build a robust social contract, which means that we could mobilize an all-of-society response led by political leaders, health experts, civil society, and the private sector to combat the pandemic this time around in the year 2020. And you see investments in health infrastructure, non-health infrastructure, as well as a cohesive social compact or social contract are defining characteristics of the Asian response since 2003, and that's what we've done well.
So how is this sort of skewed media coverage related to larger issues of exclusion in global health and its history?
We'll begin with the history of the term global health. Before global health, we had the term international health. Before international health, we had the term tropical health or tropical medicine. One of the pioneer schools in the world is a school called the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, LSHTM. They've done a great service to the world by combating many infectious diseases, but the usage of the word hygiene is sometimes controversial because it indicates that the places that they work in, for example, tropical countries, are not hygienic. The concept of tropical medicine also comes because the colonial administrators like the British, the Spanish and so on had an interest in preserving the health of the people that they sent there. Soldiers, merchants, business people, as well as administrators. They were less interested in the health of the natives, if I could use the word. They were more interested in preserving the health of the colonizers. And that's how the term tropical health comes about. International health and global health are new, more political correct terms, also to fight the scale of the problems that we have today, like climate change, refugees, migrants, and so on, definitely need a very global component to it. That's the history of global health, tropical health, as well as tropical medicine. Zooming and fast forward to today, this has a few specific problems. Researchers, policymakers, thought leaders from the global south may have trouble accessing the power centers and decision-making rooms of the global north, because they're systematically excluded. This is not only a global health problem, but this is also a problem in global governance. For example, decision-making frameworks in the IMFs, International Monetary Funds, the World Banks of the world are closed to people from the emerging world. So this is not only a problem for global health, but also a problem for global economics, global security, global development, and anything with the word global behind it.
So articles like this are a small part of a larger movement to decolonize global health. Why is this important and how can it be done?
It's important for several reasons, and I'm glad you brought this up. The reason why we need to decolonize are a few. The first one being, we cannot have decision makers making decisions for the global south, and there are people commanding vast sums of money, despite the best intentions, and I trust the intentions of very many of these people. The fact remains that their decision-making could be clouded by bias, given that they have not spent too much time in the global south, or they are not the recipients of this aid, or scholarships, or grants. Therefore, having diverse voices in the decision-making room is important so that we have equality. That's one big reason why. The second reason why is to break the cycles of power. And when I say cycles of power, just like in many other sectors, global health have many power centers. The redistribution of power or the decentralization of power away from capital cities like Brussels and Geneva, New York and Washington, the more traditional power centers of the world, and spreading them to, let me invent a few examples, to Delhi, to Addis Ababa, to Jakarta, is very important so that we can share in the not only the decision-making, but also in the power structures that define how the world is governed. These are two very good reasons why we should decolonize global health. How can we do this? In ways that are big and small. Let me do the small ways first before ending with the big ways. In small ways, it requires people in the global north to be comfortable and generous and willing to give up their power, decision-making privileges, money and funding to people in the global south. When I say give up, it's actually a form of sharing because we're actually preserving the ideals that they signed up for in the first place, equality, justice, and global development. And I think a reasonable case can be made, and many people are already doing this. Secondly, a small way, it's actually pretty big, but I'll label it as small, is to say that researchers in the emerging world or the global south, like in Malaysia, should ask for and participate in discussions at the global in the global arena. Meaning, it's not enough for Malaysian researchers and Malaysian policymakers and Malaysian leaders to stay in Malaysia. We have to go out, perhaps firstly in Southeast Asia, then to Asia Pacific, then into the world. Public goods like vaccines are global public goods rather than local public goods. And if you want to save Malaysians, then you really have to get a seat at the international table. That's another way that that we can equalize the playing field a little bit. And I would say that's a little, shall we say, small compared to the really big ones. And the really big ones require political will. on the part of government, for example, the government of Malaysia, there needs to be more assertive, I will use this word, in asking for, maybe even demanding a role at the global decision-making table. And secondly, this requires more multilateral commitments to, in the sense that Malaysia alone is probably not strong enough a voice to ask for a seat, for example, in the governing board of the World Health Organization, or in Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, or in CEPI, the coalition that comes up with new innovations to fight pandemics. Malaysia needs to ask for a seat at the table. However, Malaysia's government may be too small because we're only the 46th most populous country in the world. Therefore, it's important that Malaysia uses and leverages, for example, ASEAN. 650 million people, a $3 trillion US dollar economy, the most populous Muslim country in the world, that's Indonesia, combined forces could have a much stronger voice. Now, that's a big challenge because ASEAN has traditionally been about non-intervention and respecting sovereignty. But the point is, if Malaysia wants to punch above our weight, we probably need to do it through ASEAN, and that's the really big challenge.
And to bring it back to the question of media coverage, what can those of us, you know, who are working in the media, what can we do to provide more balanced coverage to global health issues like the pandemic?
If the message goes out to the likes of the New York Times and the Guardian, it would be to say to open up the diversity of your voices, meaning to have people writing about Southeast Asia who are Southeast Asians themselves, and not just a parachuted journalist writing an opinion piece without having really lived in a particular culture. This requires a change in the business model, the philosophy, and so on, and coming on the background of a crisis in media as well, because of fake news and disinformation, misinformation. It is a bit of a tall order, I understand, but it requires the global media to take responsible positions. And I quoted a few examples earlier. That's the first thing that the media can do in the international stage. In Malaysia, what we can do is to start talking to change our discourse a little bit in Malaysian media by starting to talk more about regional and global issues, beyond just a superficial coverage. What I mean to say is we can get Malaysians to report on how they see the world and to talk about issues that are not ordinarily spoken about. For example, the COVID vaccine. Another example would be the logistics of mass vaccination programs. A third example would be what are other countries doing in relation to travel bubbles and how we can open up a Southeast Asia regional travel zone. All these conversations are important conversations, and decisions are made outside of Kuala Lumpur and Putrajaya, which is why Malaysian media should begin engaging in coverage for these kind of issues where decisions are made outside of Malaysia's borders.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Kaur. That was health policy specialist Dr. Kaur speaking. You know, I don't know about you guys. Have you tried to or, you know, even considered diversifying your global media news to get more accurate updates on the non-Western world?
I did. I started doing this a few from when I was back in university. So I remember when I first started reading more about global news, it was a lot of all the usual CNN, BBC. And then when I was in university, one of my professors made me realize that a lot of these are very Western-centric. A lot of these perspectives are very much from journalists who are sitting in, you know, these so-called developed Western countries. And they don't always provide a more a holistic, comprehensive picture of what's happening in these so-called underdeveloped countries, you know. And that's, so I started looking at places like Al Jazeera, South China Morning Post and stuff like that. And I find that that helps to sort of, you get both sides. You can see how, you can compare how different the reporting is when you read Al Jazeera, for example, versus when you read the exact same issue on CNN.
That's right.
And yeah, and I like, you know, the whole idea of, you know, the Western perspective. The thing that always bothers me is they always seem to put themselves on this high horse and everyone else is beneath them. And that's how they sort of, that's their narrative. Because even when you look at movie news and things like that, or when they're talking about box office and all, a lot of times when these film pundits and all, when they're doing the analysis, they always just talk about the US box office and just brush off the rest of the world? Or, you know, if a movie does really well in other parts of the world, but not in the US, they will brush it off as like, oh, you know, that's the overseas audience. What do they know? They don't literally, like, you know, phrase it that way, but that's always the sentiment. Mm. And that always bothers me. So yeah, when it comes to serious news and all, I think Al Jazeera is a good one for me as well.
Mm. Yeah. I think for me, what I noticed was, like, you know, because obviously we went through it first, right? Mm. We put in the lockdowns, we did the measures, mm. we flattened the curve, and then, you know, then it sort of hit the European countries and America and all of that. And then because I consume a lot of media from those two countries in particular, it was like, wow, we've already dealt with all of this, and you guys, this is all like news to you.
Yeah.
Sure, and there's no sort of like research done by the reporters there to compare to other countries who've, you know, been there and done that. There wasn't that. It was just like, wow, this is the new thing that has come up from the pandemic. Sorry, lots of people have gone through it and we've already sorted it out. You know, maybe do a bit of research. And
I think even now, you know, a lot of these articles also still sort of just very nicely ignore what's happening in the other countries, unless it's something that's very focused, or like what, you know, we were talking about earlier, it's only just like cherry-picked countries, Japan, South Korea, but a lot of countries like Vietnam did so well, countries like Ghana did so well. It's just recognizing that, you know, maybe other countries do have better healthcare than yours.
Yeah.
And also when it comes, you know, another example that at one point it really bothered me was when the whole Doraemon thing happened here, right? There were a lot of American journalists who, you know, in their YouTube videos or whatever, they came out and said, oh, in the middle of a pandemic, Malaysian Women and Family Development Ministry, you know, they put out this sort of sexist sort of statement and all these sorts of things, which, yeah, it's true. You know, we talked about it here as well. But at the same time, I'm thinking, in the US, you guys are arguing about masks, whether or not you should be wearing masks, which Asian countries and even like African countries and all, they don't do. All of us know that it's just, you know, it's something to protect ourselves and protect each other. So what's the big deal? But in US, and especially in US, it's a whole political thing. You know, only the liberals wear masks, the conservatives don't wear masks, left wing, right wing. So I don't know, it's kind of crazy over there.
It's mind-boggling. Yeah. But you know, if you are interested, the writer of that Medium article is also writing a series called COVID Underdogs, which highlights the achievements of non-Western countries in handling the pandemic. So just Google his name, Indy Samarajiva, and COVID Underdog. So we're going to take a quick break now. We're going to leave you with Queen to keep you company. Here's I Want to Break Free. You're listening to The Daily Digest on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.